Welcome back to Embracing Your Mortality with me, Sue Brain. Over the winter, I've been talking to some amazing people, including an expert in the art of developing good listening skills.
We start to see each other as humans with similar feelings, even though they've gone off in completely different directions.
A UFO and near-death researcher.
Maybe there's only a few other topics in this world that are more important than this, I think. That maybe is the life after death.
And a remarkable gardener who helps his clients to connect and integrate their way of working with nature and ecology.
The key to enjoying life here is actually treating it like a huge adventure. Why does that caterpillar curl in that fashion? Why is the snail's wall like that?
I'm delighted to introduce Maggie Latterell, author of The Gift of Alzheimer's, an account of her mother's transcendent Alzheimer's journey, which is now being adapted for a radio play starring Juliet Stevenson.
I was living in London and I was busy with a practice, a therapy practice, and also teaching every month. You know, I had students who used to travel from Europe and book hotels and flights, you know, a year ahead of time. So that was the scary part, managing that and just praying that there wouldn't be a crisis, you know, when I had a teaching commitment. And there never was. The angels looked after me. I would say that before that, in the 90s, my parents lived in Troon, which is on the west coast of Scotland, a very, very nice town about 30 miles southwest of Glasgow on the coast. And I loved going there. And I can remember walking along the beach one day, carefree, when suddenly I thought, in the next 10 years, I'm going to lose the three closest members of my family.
Wow.
And it was like, I'm getting a shiver as I say that. My sister was a long-term alcoholic, and I knew that she wouldn't live that long. My mother was in her late 80s or mid-80s, and my father was in his early 90s. So that was quite a shocking thought.
Do you know where that came from?
I think it's just when you walk along a beach on your own, I allow thoughts to come to me. And I suppose, you know, I was just observing my parents getting more frail, stumbling a little bit. There was some evidence that, you know, we were heading that way. And I could have just walked away from that and pretended it wasn't happening. But because I'd been interested in spirituality, I'd been on a spiritual path for 40 years before that. So I thought, I'm going to embrace this. I signed up for a course with William Bloom on death and dying. And I think I did a couple of courses with him on that because I thought, I need to be prepared. I hate saying this, but I came from a very dysfunctional family. You know, my mother had postnatal depression and nervous breakdowns, and I think we'd probably been diagnosed as bipolar. And my father, you know, having fought in the war, was quite emotionally absent, you know, just grit your teeth and get on with it. And it was very volatile. I think there was a lot of healing to do. And I think at an unconscious level or subconscious level, I wanted to do some repair work, some healing work. I just made a decision. I'm going to make my parents a priority at the end of their lives. And that turned out to be a 10-year period.
Wow, 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you embrace their mortality.
I did.
Yeah,
absolutely. And things got progressively more difficult, as you would expect. And I can remember my friends in London saying, oh, poor you, you need some retail therapy. But actually, having been on this spiritual journey myself, I was fascinated by what was happening. My experience over the 40 years had been largely knowing about, going to workshops, reading books, teaching, working with clients. And there's a difference between knowing about and knowing.
Yes, there is.
I discovered when I was accompanying my parents, both of them, and, you know, on their journeys, that I was shifting from knowing about to knowing because they were teaching me. they taught me.
Did they both teach you the same thing, or did you feel like they were teaching you different things from the way that they were entering their dying process?
Alzheimer's, as we know, can be very difficult, especially in the beginning and the middle phases when people are in denial and battling. And my mother, who had Alzheimer's, was no exception to that. But there comes a point where people cannot keep that up and they are forced into a state of surrender. And that was when the really interesting things started to happen. Well, the things that were of interest to me started to happen. For example, she said, it's difficult being working in two worlds. Now, because of my journey, I immediately sort of leapt on that, said, tell me more. But, you know, a nurse, a doctor would probably have said, she's hallucinating.
Yes. Yeah.
What was interesting to me was that the more that I validated what she was saying, she became very sensitive and she knew that I knew. She did. She knew that I knew. And because she knew that, she trusted me. And the more I validated what she was saying, because I knew about it, the more she told me.
Wow. So you really gave her permission to have that experience.
Yes. And she gave me permission. She said, you must tell others. So she knew that what the journey we were on together was important.
Gosh, that's remarkable, isn't it? Considering she'd come from a place of a difficult life, confusion, denial, and suddenly she knew.
Yes.
Yeah. I wonder what was happening in her brain.
Well, at one point she said, there's the brain and the mind, and I make a very clear distinction between the brain and the mind, because what she demonstrated to me, without any doubt, was non-locality of mind. Mm. At one point she said, I have no brain cells left. But to be able to make that assessment, which was accurate, pretty accurate, there needed to be another level of knowing.
And that had to be cognitive too, because it makes sense.
Yeah.
She's telling a story.
Yes.
I think loads of people dying know.
Exactly.
They don't say anything because they haven't got the support around them or the understanding. Maybe in a hospice, but that's still pretty clinical.
I've been around people dying with cancer. They go through similar, you know, periods of lucidity, terminal lucidity. That's quite common and written about and researched. Mm. I'd say Alzheimer's is a protracted end-of-life experience. In my mother's case, we had 3.5 years. When she started to say interesting things and said, you can tell others, I thought, well, this might be going on for a few months. She seemed extremely frail. Little did I know, 3.5 years later, I'd still be taking notes and that there would be enough communication between us for it to be meaningful.
So the glimpses that she gave you, I mean, since you've been on this spiritual journey, so you obviously have an understanding of perhaps what happens, but those glimpses, those personal glimpses she gave you, what were the most impactful for you?
She had two voices. So there was, you know, I want to get up, you know, I can't move. And then there was the other voice, I've never felt better. You know, I am getting better. She came through with a voice of authority, which I think was coming from somewhere else.
And I imagine the getting better was actually dying.
Yes. Yeah. I think one of the things that surprised me was around thought. She said, I'm confused when I can't remember, but I know my thoughts are clear. And I thought, well, I'd never even thought about that. I kept that thought in my mind, and I would quite often ask her, are you thinking? And she'd say, I'm thinking a lot. So it suggested to me that people might lose the ability to, in their brain, to connect up thoughts and words and express them. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're not thinking.
Well, it's just very interesting you say that, because I sat beside my dad as he was dying. He had a massive stroke. So basically semi-conscious or unconscious most of the time for 8 days. He was a schoolmaster. So he was a big reader and researcher and, you know, really engaged with what was going on in the world. And he would put his hand to his cheek in a certain way when he was reading a book. And it was just a very well-known gesture for me when he was absorbing information. And he lay on his deathbed doing exactly the same thing. He held his cheek in exactly the same way. And he was listening with such intent that I knew he was being prepared to die. There was this sense of being taught.
There are some themes that ran through these 3 years, which I think are important for, you know, to say. And the first is love. Love underpinned the whole journey. It was when I started to really feel compassion for my mother. I didn't say anything, but she said to me, "You love me." She saw love coming from me. She said some beautiful things. You know, love is passing between us. You know, love never dies. Remember, she said, remember about love and feel it. It's not just a thought, feel it.
I think that's the dying do teach us that, don't they? Because in my experience of being present with people who are dying, also having interviewed so many people about end of life and death and dying, that love becomes incredibly present at the end of the life. And that's even when people are really not having a good death and fighting against it. The people who are witnessing that and willing to sit there with them in their pain and their struggle are providing such love. I believe that's what takes us across.
I'll tell you a story about my father. He was 98 and I had planned to go away on a co-housing weekend and paid for it and everything. And I suddenly thought, I'm not going. I'm going up to Scotland. So I just got on a train the next day, got to Scotland. He was fine. That was a Thursday. On Friday, took him out in a wheelchair for a walk. Fine. He was in great form. About 5 o'clock, the care home phoned me and said, he's had a turn. I think you should come. So I knew that he was going to pass. So I got my son and my niece on the phone so they could chat. They were completely bamboozled by this. And I was with him. And he kind of drifted in and out of consciousness. And then suddenly, when I thought he was just passing, he suddenly shouted at the top of his voice, "Love!"
Wow.
And passed.
Was that a word that he would be comfortable saying in his life anyway? Or was it, do you feel like he was having a completely different experience?
There was a lot of love between him and me. And because I'd had the experience with Mummy and, you know, I knew how important love was. After she passed, I spent 3 years supporting him in a similar way. So I was showing him love and he felt very loved. Love became very much part of his experience towards the end. But before that, no, you know, he was a Scottish golf club.
I mean, Maggie, do you feel like he saw love? Do you feel like he had an incredibly powerful experience of love?
I think that he might have been influenced by things that I was saying, because I think I said to him, know that you are loved. I knew he was going and I just knew that was important. He didn't shout this out immediately after I'd said that, but it was in the field.
Did either of your parents talk about seeing apparitions? And Peter Fennick and I used to call them apparitions and people coming to collect them. And
Yes. Both of them had that towards the end. So Mummy said that she didn't realise that they were her deceased relatives. She said, my father visited and my mother. And she talked to my sister who'd already passed by then. She said, she's doing fine. And as if it was just everyday conversation. And she also said, I'm waiting for messages to come through. And my father, near the end, I went to visit him one day, and he was sitting by the window, and I came through the door, and he's saying, "Come here, come here, come here," really eager, couldn't wait to tell me. And he told me about, like a dream, but I don't know that it, I think it was an experience he had. Two men were, there was a sort of tunnel somewhere, and two men were asking him to go with them. He said no. What he said to me was more real than real. And I knew that that was an experience out of this world.
So do you think he said no at that point?
He wanted me to be with him.
And you think he stayed until you were there?
Absolutely. No doubt.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Maybe he got collected then.
Yes.
And left.
Yes, and my mother said something else about being collected. I think she had three opportunities to go. The first, she talked about programs and getting her energies in the right position for the next program. She actually used words like that. The first program finished, and then the second, she had the second program, and she said she didn't like it. Now, I think these programs were for learning. Mm. I think they were for cleansing. And then the third program she did like. And it was after the third program, she said something about, it's finished. My supervision is finished. I've passed all the tests. She used these very words.
And how long before she died was she using those words?
Well, the programs happened over a couple of years.
I think we start our dying process a long before that we actually begin to die.
Yes.
There's a sense of getting ready, unconsciously.
Yes.
But I'm pretty sure that that's what happens.
I agree.
And Maggie, I know you turned your journey with your mum into a book. What was that like for you to write this story?
Whoa. Well, I knew when I had all that material and she told me to tell others there was a book there. But I parked it for 3 years because I didn't want to be writing about my mother's experiences when I was looking after my father. So I gave him 100% of my attention. And then after my grieving process, I started to write. And I decided to write in the first person in present time. And that was so tough. I thought I had done work. I had masses and masses of therapy. I thought that I had, you know, done the work. But when I was writing, there probably wasn't a day when I didn't shed some tears. Mm. It was a deep, deep healing process for me. It was quite cathartic.
What was the most powerful, I suppose it would be a revelation, if you like, as you were writing the book? Was it about your own death or your own journey, or was it just purely about your mum and your relationship with her?
It was about her and the family, because although the book was 3.5 years of recorded conversations with her, so it was mainly about her. But, you know, she said about my father, He has lessons to learn. So it was also about the family and the person passing all this psychic and amazing information to my mother was my deceased sister, who had been the black sheep of the family.
So they were working together.
My late sister and my mother were working.
And she was in spirit working with your mum.
Yes. When my mother said, William has lessons to learn, I knew that I had a job there to help him with the same lessons that she'd been learning. I think the more work you've done yourself, the more effective a companion you can be. Because if I hadn't had 40 years of meditation and, you know, learning, I wouldn't have recognized some of the things that were happening. And I wouldn't have wholeheartedly been able to endorse them. And it was that led to trust. And when I was writing the book, I just completely absorbed myself in the material. Mm. I hardly did anything else when I was writing the first draft. You know, I'd go and walk on Hampstead Heath, but I didn't socialize much.
After you finished the book, Maggie, what happened to you then? Because I know you got it published and it's done very well.
It shifted me from knowing about to absolutely knowing. So, you know, I don't have a fear of death. Like, death is the ultimate fear, I think. So if you don't fear death, it's like, life is okay, whatever's happening. It's kind of how I feel. That's a huge gift that I have had from that. When I finished the book, I had a couple of really good editors, wonderful editors that taught me a lot about writing. Because I'm not a writer. Well, I'm a writer now, but I didn't think of myself as a writer. I self-published because I didn't want this book to be hanging around doing nothing. And then I attended a Watkins event for writers, took my self-published book to the editorial team, and they decided to publish it. And I managed to get Neil Donald Walsh to write the foreword.
Wow. So, do you feel like your mum was helping you from the other side with all of this? Do you have a sense that she was present?
Yeah, I do. It's like I carry everything that she gave me with me. And that's timeless. I had to do most of my own publicity because the publisher at Watkins was ill and left and this and that. And the window for promoting my book kind of disappeared. So I had to do most of it myself. And I spent a couple of years giving talks on the subject to the Scientific and Medical Network and the Confederation of Healing Organizations, and did a conference with Anthony Peake. We did a conference together at the College for Psychic Studies.
Yeah.
It was a very exciting time. Mm-hmm. I produced a PowerPoint. I went through the book with a tooth comb, and I picked out the essential elements and created a PowerPoint, which I continue to use. Really, really useful to have all that information in one place. During this time, it was actually an Anthony Peake talk, and I met someone called Brian Murray, who was a very famous theatre director. He read my book, contacted me because we lived nearby, and said, I'd like this to be a play. Do you agree? And I said, yes. So we met and we had chats and used to meet, you know, regularly. And we didn't actually talk about the play. We talked about life and, you know, spirituality and things. And he died suddenly just after he had got a production company on board. And I thought, oh, they'll drop it now because he was the big pull. But actually, I managed to persuade the producer to take on his son, Jake Murray, as the director. And I found a scriptwriter. So the scriptwriter produced a version for stage, but then COVID broke and there was no way it was going into theatres. Very little is going into theatres at the moment. So the producer then decided to make an audio, to do it as an audio, because that meant writing a new script. And we were talking about I'd like Juliet Stevenson. And lo and behold, he got Juliet Stevenson to play my part and Jane Lapoterre to play the part of my mother. And I was in London before Christmas, attending a week of rehearsals.
Wow.
Which was just fantastic. I loved every minute of it. And then on the last day on the Friday, we did recordings with Juliet. It should do well.
Oh, well, I mean, it's what your mum was saying. Share this.
Yes.
It's interesting about the time lapse.
Well, she passed in 2007.
Yeah, and it's now 2022.
I didn't start working on the book till 2010 because that was the year that my father passed.
I think when we get a message, we tend to think, oh, it's now. I think everything needs time to gestate, doesn't it? It's like, you know, the seed is planted and you can't make a seed grow overnight. It's just not possible. It needs this time, becomes a little bit of a bigger plant. And then at some point it flowers. It sounds like to me sort of symbolically, this is what's happened to the project from your mother sowing that seed within you, in your psyche.
Absolutely. And it's very much part of me now. You know, I don't see it as something separate. You know, I could almost recite everything she said because it's so much part of me. And I deeply, deeply appreciate it. It's a gift. A psychic friend of mine in London, who was a member of the Scientific and Medical Network, I consulted him several times, and he said that this is a gift for me to make up for the very troubled childhood I had. That was what he said.
Yeah, what a gift. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, the difficult moments are our growing edge, really. What's the name of the audio play?
Between Two Worlds.
Between Two Worlds. What is your vision now?
Juliet Stevenson did another recording of part that wasn't recorded before Christmas. I have wanted to be involved in the whole process. Actually had that written into my contract. And I have been, and I have I've contributed, and I certainly will contribute to the editing. I'll let the professionals do their job, but then I will want to come in and just find out if it sits well. The producer is also an award-winning filmmaker, and he's saying it would make a great film.
Wow.
It could be the next, who knows?
Why not? Why not? I mean, that sounds a fantastic project. Yes. So everything she said is coming into being.
It is. And I think just what came up, it's given me wisdom at this time in my life. You know, I'm a senior. I'm an elder. And it's a time in life to take stock and to share our wisdom.
Lots and lots of people have very difficult relationships with their parents. And what wisdom would you like to pass on to them?
Might consider counselling or therapy to help them understand themselves, because you can't necessarily change other people, but you can change your own attitude. Mm-hmm. As a therapist, one of the positions that I took was people make the best choices they can at the time with the resources available. If they could have done anything else, they would have done. I think when you have a better understanding, it creates a space in which love can.
Yes.
You know,
yes. Soften.
Yes. And when your parents are, when my parents were old and frail, I felt compassion. I couldn't not feel compassion.
That was Maggie Latourelle. Please go to maggielatourelle.com for more information about her work, her workshops, and about the audio play that is currently being developed from her book. My next guests are husband and wife team Claire and Chris Sands, who've set up a podcast to address 101 different experiences of loss and grief.
Losses make you the person that you are, and it's about kind of embracing them, but you find a way to sort of make them part of your life going forward, and not necessarily a bad, scary part, but just a part of who you are.
If you haven't already, don't forget to listen to the first 3 series of Embracing Your Mortality. Links to all my guests in all the series can be found on my website, suebrain.co.uk. In the meantime, here's to living more consciously for a better world.
The Embracing Your Mortality podcast was researched and recorded by Sue Brain and produced and edited by The Podcast Den.